WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air.
I know the one thing we did right,
hey, was the day we started to fight. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on, hold on. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on.
Eyes on the Prize, Public TV's award-winning documentary series, began its second season 3 weeks ago. Eyes on the Prize chronicles the civil rights movement. The series was created by my guest, executive producer Henry Hampton. The first season covered the civil rights movement as it was unfolding in the South, the sit-ins, freedom rides, and the march from Selma to Montgomery, Alabama in 1965. This season, the focus shifts to the North, where the battle lines weren't as clear. The series uses archival footage from the period, including TV news footage from local and national broadcasts. I wanted to know how Henry Hampton thought television coverage changed once the movement moved up north.
Well, there are a combination of factors, and one of the realities is that the instrument of television is really a new instrument in the early days of the movement, and it comes to learn some powerful lessons. It comes to learn that the morality play that's being acted out on the streets of the South makes for great television. You have tremendous villains. You have enormous moral strength of Dr. King and the marchers and the disciplined nonviolent movement. It is really unprecedented in terms of television, and it has an enormous impact on the instrument itself. Which really grows up in the early stages of the civil rights movement. It also learns some bad lessons, which is that graphic violence and confrontation make great television. And as the battles of the civil rights era move to the north, the instrument finds that it can attract ratings and indeed audience by coverage of the violent confrontations. There are the realities that whereas many of the journalists and electronic and print are with the movement in the early stages, they are physically with them, looking outward at the difficult and dangerous sheriffs. By the time you move north, in many cases, those same journalists are standing behind police lines. The time that we reach when black Americans say to white journalists, we're going to have this meeting without you, or you can't come in here because you have misinterpreted or misrepresented, is a change point, because it really changes the basic relationship between the movement and media. But there was clearly a point at which people were suspicious and frustrated by the fact that their story was being told by almost all white people, and it was being told oftentimes incorrectly. And that frustration acted itself out by people saying, well, we just as soon not have anyone here while we try to come to grips with some of these issues and problems.
Now, how did those decisions of not having the press around affect you in putting together Eyes on the Prize, too? Because it means that there were probably certain really interesting inside events that weren't being filmed.
Well, don't forget, the press was around. What people said was that they always allowed the black press in. What they were oftentimes resistant to was opening it up to general press coverage.
Mm-hmm.
So there were witnesses inside of the events that people don't think happened because the white press wasn't there. There were many fine black journalists who reported and gave dimension, oftentimes critical of what was going on. But they did it, I think, in a different way than people who perhaps didn't understand the full context of those events. But whenever you move away from the kind of public confrontations that occurred in the South, you're going to run into a more difficult story to cover. It happened in the South as well. It is very easy to cover the notion of a black American attempting to get their rights to vote when it's being resisted by state troopers and the kind of violence that was visited upon people who tried to vote. That makes great copy. And it's very hard to watch that same person, having achieved that right to vote, go about the business of learning the nature of citizenship, for watching how black and white communities circled each other for a long time, struggling around new power relationships. These are things that media didn't do very well in the South. And when you bring them into the North, where you have the complexity of the urban environment and the really enormously sophisticated opposition that is practiced on the movement in the North, it becomes even more difficult.
What are some of the most interesting sources for the film that you're using in the current series of Eyes on the Prize?
Well, interestingly, we move into a period where there's much more coverage. People are picking up portable cameras. There are a lot of young people now who are involved and interested in the movement, and the excitement of what's going on in both the student movement and the civil rights movement is providing enormous material for new young journalists and new young documentarians. So there is a rich source in the second series that you don't have in the first. For example, there is some marvelous footage in the show that's coming on next Monday called The Promised Land of Dr. King, as he and the people of SCLC struggle to come up with reasonable strategies to get the society to come to grips with the issue of poverty. People rarely see, I think, leaders in this kind of candid exchange amongst staff members where they argue and scratch and claw trying to find what are proper and reasonable strategies. And there is footage inside the Black Panther headquarters in Chicago in show 206 as they know that they are under scrutiny and surveillance by the FBI and the Chicago police and are preparing to react. The sources in the second series tend to be less the networks, although an enormous amount of the material is from the network archives, and more from local stations. And there's both good news and bad news there. The local stations oftentimes had good coverage, and many of them have taken the positive step of archiving it with local universities and reservoirs that are going to protect it. But all too much of the material was lost because it was not of value immediately after broadcast. And so many of the stories that might have been covered originally, we've lost that material. And there's an interesting technical point here is that now as we enter the era of videotape, where there are fewer and fewer things are outtakes of material. Almost everything that's preserved are the edited stories. So rather than having a bulk of material from which one can work, we are almost limited to the point of view, whether it be right or wrong, broad or narrow, of the person that edited the original story. So series like Eyes on the Prize are not going to be possible in the same way because there won't be the raw material from which one can edit.
Mm-hmm. Are there incidents that really look different to you now, looking at it as history, than they did to you at the time?
Oh, I think Malcolm is the perfect example of something that we all lived through. Probably 95% of the broadcast audience or the United States of America perceived Malcolm as he was portrayed by a few gatekeepers as being largely an advocate of Black supremacy and anti-white rhetoric. And surely Malcolm in his early years did parrot and use that language and felt strongly about white crimes against Black blacks. But if you have to do is watch Malcolm a little bit to begin to understand how complex and how smart this man is and how he was changing. He was changing right before our eyes, becoming really a very important international leader. And I think people will see that footage of Malcolm sitting in Egypt talking about human rights, the notion of taking the case of Black Americans to the United Nations. Very sophisticated stuff, very different than the single image that was used to portray him. And there is, I think, a great lesson to be learned that when you are offered interpretations of particular characters, that one need take another look and then perhaps another look before you reach judgment. And I think that happens over and over again within the movement, that there are moments which are either by virtue of the emotion or of the moment, people refuse to take the second look or the second step, and they are caught in time with that reaction to what they've been told.
Is there a sequence in Eyes 2 that is particularly painful or disturbing to you looking back?
There are a couple of moments that stop me. I guess there are two of them that I still find the most difficult. The first is Dr. King in Chicago. If you really have come to understand the power of the Southern movement, you're aware of just what's at stake when we begin to find out it doesn't work up here, and yet it could, it had the capacity to work here, and as you watch it sort of unravel itself, to me it is very much a lost moment in the society that is impossible to reconstruct. There is the loss of Malcolm. I don't think people understand what a power that he could have been. He could have been as important in reaching African Americans in the urban environment as Dr. King was at reaching people in the South in the church-based movement. Together, if these two men had continued to move closer together, that we could have had a coalition of just enormous power that could have joined with the other members of labor and the churches. And if we had not gotten caught in the disaster of the Vietnam War, we literally could have changed the world and the country in that space in the 60s. And instead of having the kind of painful explosions that did occur.
Were you active in the civil rights movement yourself when you were younger?
Well, I was. I'm a good middle-class kid, and I went to Washington University in St. Louis. And in 1959 and 60, when I was going through, the restaurants around that school did not serve blacks. And there was a core chapter in St. Louis that connected with a few of us at the university. We just decided to go find out why we couldn't be served. And so for the last couple of years of my college life, we used to sit in. But after I graduated from school and after we'd successfully desegregated some of those restaurants, I really was not directly involved and only got re-involved in 1965 in Selma when I was the press officer for the Unitarian Church and went back to with the denomination because a white minister, James Reeb, had been killed.
You've spoke during this interview of the importance of both Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. I was wondering if in the 1960s, when they were both still alive, if you felt that you had to somehow align yourself with one or the other, choose one's tactics over the other, and not, as you do now, see both as being really important for what they did. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, yes, I do. Most black Americans will now stand up, and when you say Malcolm, they'll either be neutral or they'll be positive about Malcolm. But in reality, most of us, when we first heard about Malcolm X, were scared to death. There was this man who was saying things that had some vague resonance in your soul, but they were also scary. And you also disagreed with some of the notions of race that were put forth early by Malcolm. I remember the first time I ever saw him was in Leverett House at Harvard. I was visiting a friend there, and Malcolm was speaking and just mesmerizing the audience. But he was talking about the failure of integration. And I had been someone raised to believe in integration and to pursue it assiduously, almost uncritically. And I stood up to take exception. And I've always been fond of Malcolm because while he did decimate me, he left me enough self-respect to sit back down quietly. You know, he was so smart and bright about both black history and the role of black Americans in this society. What he did was he provided sort of the other half. The manhood is a bad word because it excludes, but it, basically I can't think of the sense of self and the demand for respect that Malcolm put forth. Martin surely did, but Martin was in many ways ahead of his time. What a brilliant, wonderful notion to save a society through nonviolence. But as you do that, there is a cost to it. And if you are Dr. King, it doesn't matter because you believe so deeply in nonviolence. Your sense of self is anchored in the philosophy. But for most people, if somebody hits you in the nose and you don't react, there's an emotional cost. As healthy as it is not to, I think Malcolm's not being violent, because you really won't find any examples of Malcolm being involved in direct violence except his own death. There's much more death, in fact, around the nonviolent civil rights movement. But there was in Malcolm's demand that no, don't touch me, or certainly don't beat or strike my women, that was just a powerful and I think important step for many of us who were struggling with what was a reasonable strategy to correct the ills in the society.
Do you find yourself looking at the events around you today and thinking, if I were to do Eyes on the Prize 3 in a few years, what from today and from yesterday would be in it?
Well, history is really, I really do believe history empowers, and it empowers because it allows you to make connections. There's no way you can sit in the city of Boston in the last 6 weeks reacting to the Stewart case and the kind of emotional terror and hurt that the city has undergone and make any sense of it. But if you have the connections to the historical moment, I think you get a sense of really what's possible and where we are. And one of the things history tells you is that it's oftentimes difficult to figure out. And when things seem the darkest, it's right before something is about to happen. If you look at the world in 1953, in 1954, even after the Brown decision, it doesn't look terribly positive for change. And yet history gives us the kind of vision that says there were an enormous number of forces building up so that when 54 happens and the signal of the Brown decision happens, that you have a race of people that's ready, you have a nation that's ready to undo its negative heritage. And so in 10 years, the first stage of the civil rights movement happens quickly and efficiently and marvelously. It was a miracle that it occurred and changed our nation. I think now, as I look back, you can begin to see that we are right at the edge of something. I think we are looking at a generation of black leadership and white leadership that has gone through a doldrum and is now getting ready to assault the problems that bedevil us.
Henry Hampton is the creator and executive producer of the public television series Eyes on the Prize. He's also the co-author of the companion book, Voices of Freedom.